Yeah, she's been on the website, and she goes to all the ham expositions with her father. Yeah, I'm well aware of them. I've lusted after Bengali cheese ever since I got my license, although, like I told you, I finally settled on a Chevron from the UK, which I like. It's nice. It's pretty.
Absolutely. Well, you have a treasure, and I'm getting a gem.
Yes, enjoy it well. Have lots and lots of fun with it. It's, I think I remember it. I'll look it up later, but because I've been to that website hundreds of times, so it's been that page I think since the very beginning of my lust for their keys. So I'm sure you're going to have a lot of enjoyable hours banging away on it.
Especially as I get my code speed up. Anyway, I've been listening. It's a very interesting net tonight. And, thank you as always.
Ah, you're welcome, Sam, and I appreciate your participation. Once again, this is AC2GS. My name is Roy, and this is the Limark Technical Net. We still have about 15 minutes to play around with, if anyone is so inclined. We've discussed simple things like ground plane quarter wave verticals and all the way to four momentum and its resolving into gravitational interaction. So we've gone a whole bunch of steps from small to extra large. But, like I said, we still have a little time left if anyone wants to take advantage of it. So if you're out there and you have a question or a comment or a topic that has popped into your brain and you'd like to share it, then hit that push to talk and tell us about it.
B2BX, though, with a comment.
Sure, Frank.
Yeah, wow. Echo link's acting a little weird, but anyway, I seem to be getting through. You're talking about CW, and I wanted to clarify. I may have misunderstood something you were saying about tuning in CW. I think at least on some of my older radios, I had radios that did not have a narrow CW filter in them. If I remember correctly, I had to tune the tone. If I were listening on an ordinary 2.4 or kilohertz filter, I had to tune in the CW signal to have approximately the same note as the radio CW offset. So if the radio, one of my radios had an 800 hertz offset, I had to listen to about an 800 hertz tone. I do not think you have that issue when you listen with a very narrow filter, at least it's less of a problem, because the filter is normally set to have it set a frequency at the right offset. Go ahead, Roy.
Okay, yeah, it might be. Historically, I haven't really kept up with the way that radio receivers dealt with CW, but yeah, makes sense.
Oh, yeah, typically in the transceivers, as I understand it, typically they're... I think the Flex lets you vary all this. I haven't really played with it, even though I use a Flex at the remote site because, it's a shared resource and I can essentially just have to get on and get off. But I think on mostly older radios, there's a CW offset set. And you kind of have to work with that. Maybe somebody else who's a serious CW operator can explain it better. Anyway, that was my two cents in with your the conversation about working CW, if I understood it correctly. Go ahead.
Okay, very good. Yeah, the flex queue adjusts the transmission bandwidth on the fly. You know, you can set it very, very narrow. You can set single sideband for extended single sideband by just moving a cursor. It's a nice feature. People can screw it up by doing wrong things, but it's more options are always better than less.
Yeah, I was kind of amazed probably a year or two ago, the expedition to Easter Island, or some people call it Rapa Nui, and this transmit frequency was being covered by, I don't remember whether it was somebody who just wasn't paying attention or whatever, and I just grabbed the cursor and made the filter as narrow as it could go, and I could not only, was able to hear the Easter Island station and then go ahead and work him, when without the really narrow filter, I couldn't copy him at all through the QRM. Go ahead.
Yeah, it is very nice. We've discussed it in the past. There's a nice, really good feature of software-defined radios is because the filters are not legacy discrete components. They're digital. You could have the sharpest skirt possible without any ringing artifacts. Very difficult to design, discrete component filters capable of doing that.
Yeah, very good. If I ever get my own flex radio, I'll have to really play with some of that stuff, but I don't think I'm going to do that anytime, since I don't live in a location where I couldn't take a $5,000 radio and plug it into a meaningful antenna. It's kind of like buying an expensive stereo and plugging it into a bunch of 3-inch tweeters. Anyway, go ahead with the next, BB2BX site.
Okie dokie, Frank. Thank you very much. Yeah, it was a big investment, and, that was around the time that I was still hunting around for trying to figure out how to get an antenna system on my roof. You know, sometimes you just say, screw it, and you only go around once, as far as I'm aware, so I put my money down. If I had to do it all over again, I would have done it the exact same way. I really like my software-defined radio, even though I could always use better and bigger antennas.
Yeah. Oh, the radios are fun, and I think we're going to get to the point where just about everything's going to be SVR, if it isn't already. And I guess the next thing is going to be AI filtering. I know we had somebody talking about what they were doing on here a couple of weeks ago. I also remember hearing somebody talking about some form of AI filtering that would just eliminate, at least in principle, eliminate all QRM and QRN from sideband and CW signals, and all you'd hear, at least in theory, is a signal. I don't know if that's really going to happen anytime soon, but certainly an interesting idea. Go ahead.
KC2GS. Well, yeah, they already do. Matter of fact, I think it was Rich W2BZ who mentioned RM Noise, which is a server-based AI noise reduction algorithm. I've installed it and used it for a couple of months on my Flex, and the new Flex 8000 comes with some kind of built-in AI noise reduction circuit. Unfortunately, they didn't write it for the 6000 series either yet or ever, so I haven't had an opportunity to test drive that. But there are already relatively simplistic AI noise reduction algorithms available, and the hope is that they will improve over time. Will they be perfect? Probably not, but they'll get better, which is a great thing. It's one of the things that AI should be somewhat useful for, that, you know, it will kind of learn from noise-distorted voice patterns and be able to synthesize a normal voice with far less noise artifacts. So that's the premise, that's the idea, and it's being implemented now as a beginning type of thing. Although the server-based RM noise has been around for a couple of years, and it like most things in amateur radio, doesn't get a lot of publicity, unfortunately.
Yeah, okay, very good. Yeah, I was just going to say, okay, if one of these things is available for Flex Radio, I'll have to ask the guy who runs the remote site whether he can put it on, but you kind of answered that question. It's not available for the, it's only available for the 8000 series, and I think he's running 5 or 6000 series. Great radios on the site. Anyway, thanks a lot, Roy. I guess it's almost time for Paul, so I'll let you move on with the next. WB2BX.
Okay, very good. Most likely he's using 6000 series. The 6000 series is more flexible about operating it remotely, so it's probably the 6000 series. And, you know, he may upgrade a few units to 8000 over time, or who knows? Maybe Flex Radio will actually pay their programmer to implement it on the 6000 series. Time will tell.
Yeah, I guess he may put the 8000 radios on some of his big sites. I just use his smaller sites. Kind of more interesting, and even the smallest site, 100 watt flex radio to a dipole at 100 feet is a heck of a lot better than anything I could ever do with an apartment station. I don't really think it's that interesting to use something with the equivalent of military grade antennas, which are available through that site if I wanted to use them and pay the piper for it. So go ahead.
Yes, indeed. I don't know. Recently I got this strange email from Flex. They usually don't mention their military equipment. This email, for some strange reason, was promoting their military radios and military antenna systems. And, you know, I think they confused my email address, but hopefully the FBI won't come knocking on my door.
Well, they probably just want to promote to the amateurs if that's what they're doing. And there are some amateurs who will, I guess, spend the 10, 12 grade equipment, I suppose, but I think they just want to promote that they're doing it. I remember seeing somewhere that the Air Force was doing a pilot project in putting some Flex Radios HF sets in strategic bombers they fly in the Indo-Pacific, where they need extremely long-range communications and redundancy to back up satellite systems. I do remember reading a couple of years ago that they're doing that. Anyway, yeah, hopefully nobody will bother you about being on that mailing list. WB2BX.
Yeah, hopefully not. I remember years ago I heard a story that Flex was had a contract with the NSA, where, you know, instead of some paltry things like, you know, 7 virtual receivers, you know, they had a slew, and the idea was it was a kind of a pan band receiver. It received everything from, you know, zero to light or close to it. So it would probably be interesting just reading over the specs of some of the hardware that they built for the government that we're paying for through our tax dollars.
Yeah, I remember, I think it was Collins, one of the manufacturers back in the 70s, it's an ARRL, the ARRL National Convention was in New York. I remember seeing them demonstrate one of these, a zero to 30 megahertz receivers, which was a big deal back then. So I'm sure these pan-band radios can do a heck of a lot more tricks than were even dreamed of in the 1970s. Go ahead.
Yeah, thankfully it's still getting better and better. I mean, I think software-defined radios were a thing in the military way back 30 years ago. But, yeah, they had those ridiculous telephone number prices. So it was only, about 20 years ago they were able to, the guy who owned Flex wrote that article in QST about a kit that he had designed that he put together in 2 months worth of articles. I think it was the Flex 1000 he named it. So, yeah, it's getting better and better. I look forward to future inventions. And the beauty, once again, of software-defined radios is because they're primarily based on software. You change the firmware and you change the radio. You know, old legacy radios, if you wanted to have an FM demodulator, you had to build one and hook it into the circuit. Now you just kind of code for an FM demodulator, and when you boot up the radio, it has FM capability. So, brave new world we live in. Anyway, thank you so much, Frank, for your participation. And thanks to everyone's participation tonight. I enjoyed myself. I hope you enjoyed yourself. Hope you'll consider joining us next Sunday at 8 p.m. when we try and do this all over again. But now at about 10:19, it's time for Paul WS2N with the SpaceNet Report.
AC2GS WS2N. Very good topics. And, I know we talked a lot about the moon and everything else before, but usually we reserve this topic to, you know, different launches that are going up, and it's a little different than what Wesley was bringing up. Earlier tonight, I talked about the ENIAC computer. That's how we started off. And it's the 80th anniversary as of today, February 15th, when they first turned that thing on over in the University of Pennsylvania. There's another anniversary, though, and this one has to do with the moon. And the Soviet Union, 60 years ago, soft landed a vehicle on the moon called Luna 9. And, the first, they beat us to doing that. We eventually landed surveyors, half a dozen surveyors on the moon. But they got there first. It actually landed January 31st of 1966. And the thing was about the same, the lander itself was about the same size of the Sputnik, almost 24 inches in diameter, and again, it was a sphere that landed on the moon. All the other parts broke apart before they landed, and had an airbag. So when NASA landed the Pathfinder on Mars, and the two rovers, Spirit opportunity that had airbags. But it was actually derived from the Russian, you know, from the Soviet design of how they landed things on the moon, such as Luna 9. And another technology that they had was this system after this ball landed, no matter how it landed, on the side or upside down, it was going to right side itself up, because they had these, you know, half of the top of the ball, picture a basketball, and if it had these pedals on there, if they had four of them, if they would open up, and by doing that, it would rotate the ball into a proper position. You know, with the antenna sticking up, you know, the antennas that came out, and they had a camera on board, so it was actually the first taking of the moon. Then they had a mobile camera, they call it a TV camera. I think what it was a slow scan setup, but they sent some pictures back, and it operated around 3 or 4 days before it quit. So, you know, years ago, when I first got involved with ham radio, everybody would talk about the space program, and in those days, they really discussed the what went on in the old days, you know, with the orbiters that went around the moon and surveyors that landed on the moon, and all eventually all the spacecraft that went out to deep space. They were exciting at different times, but I have kind of gotten away from talking about the past. Tonight I thought I'd definitely bring this up. Luna 9 launched to the moon 60 years ago. Any comments? Okay, let me go back to the present. On Friday, just ago, early in the morning, 5 o'clock in the morning, SpaceX launched another Crew Dragon to the International Space Station. And it got there successfully after about 35 hours in orbit. You know, it does the chase, eventually catches up, and they dock with the, one of the modules, the Harmony module, they call it, the forward-facing module, part of the Harmony module. You line up all the modules in space. Harmony is like in the front, and then, you know, behind that, you have a bunch of other ones lined up, you know, behind Harmony. You know, you have Destiny, and then you have the Node 1, and behind that you have pressure mating adapter, and that continues. Eventually you pick up the Russian segments, so, you know, in line, like the front of the space station. And that's where all the Dragons and American vehicles have been docking to, you know, the you know, with the crew vehicles to the front, and to also to the Zenith-facing port, you know, the top port. They were at two locations. And the top port will temporarily be reserved for either another crew vehicle in the future or cargo vehicle. And cargo vehicles that have been docked with that are Dragon. They have a smaller diameter than the other cargo vehicles that dock with the space station. You have one there that's docked there now from Japan, called the HTV-X, and that's a very large vehicle, and that's officially not docked. They call it berth. You have a 50-inch plus wide door that opens, you know, for first vehicles, and the dock vehicles only have, you know, a meter diameter. So, they, you know, whatever you can get through there, which is the crew or you know, supplies. So the crew of four launched successfully, and happens that out of the two, you have two people that are ham radio operators on that flight, and they joined another one, Chris Williams. He's been up there on the American side by himself. He's been there with two Russians. So just three people have been on the space station for a while. You might remember not too long ago, they brought a crew of four down because of a medical emergency. And been out this four, that just went up, replaces that four. Now they're back to their normal crew on station, which is seven. So, any comments? This is WS2S.
WB2BXO.
Okay, very good. By the way, two of the crewmates are Hathaway. He's got the KJ5NIV, and then the other one is Adelot, which is from France, European Space Agency, KJ5LTN. You notice, even so, she's from France. She has an American call. You know, when they're at a station in train in Houston, even the ones that come from different countries, I gotta get a ham license. And sure enough, they wind up with American calls, and that's why most of them have five in Texas. Yeah, over to you, Frank. How are you?
Okay, very good. Pretty good. As far as I know, we really never gotten an idea as to why the crew member had to be brought back early, have we?
Yeah, that has not been released. That is standard operating procedure for NASA. If somebody gets sick, in space or not in space, that's not broadcast. The only time it is if the crew member wants to reveal that information. So we never found out, Frank.
Okay, that's what I thought. When they finally do disclose at some point, and no doubt it's going to be a really interesting story about what went on there. All right, very good. Back to listening. WB2BXO.
And they have all kinds of stuff on board, you know, even dealing with the tooth extraction they say they could do. So, you know, they have more drugs up there than probably CVS, you know, for different purposes. Whatever comes up, they pretty much can treat. But whatever this was, they didn't have it, you know. I don't know if it was a diagnostic tool that they needed or, you know, who knows what they needed. But whatever it was, they didn't have that capability. Or they did have the capability and they might have said, oh, you know, this person's got a clot or whatever it might be. Let's get them back on Earth. That could be the, you know, my guess, that's probably the problem. You know, get them back on Earth and have them treated. There was somebody with a clot many years ago. I think he was a Russian. I don't know. I don't remember the story, but they did treat the person on board. I guess medications or something. And whatever it was, that, they were able to get through that. But whatever this was, no go. They're going to need to find out what. Well, I'm sure they know what it was, but they're going to have to let NASA know, hey, you know, we need this tool up there, we need that, or, you know, a brain surgeon, whatever the problem is, with, you know, because once they start heading off the moon for sometimes a month at a time, or more, or someday in the future off to Mars, where you know you have these 3-year flights, and if you're on the way to Mars and something happens, you know that person has to be treated. There's nowhere, you know, there's no 4-day trip like you have from the moon. At least you have you know that possibility of getting back in 4 days. Mars, maybe a year or so. Over to you, Frank.
Yeah, well, I know the Mars trip is going to be very challenging from that point of view. Yeah, I don't think anybody has the vaguest idea how to get, and I know we've discussed this many times on the net, I don't think anybody really has the vaguest idea how to get humans to and from Mars safely. Sounds like it's going to require a nuclear power, which supposedly I guess NASA is working on, but it certainly looks like it's a heck of a lot harder than going to the moon. Go ahead.
Yeah, I know they're working on different. Different ways to increase the speed using nuclear fission to heat gases and have the gases, you know, expel out of the vehicle, you know, propulsion out of that. And then, they are getting better at ion, these Hall effect ion drive systems. But, you know, there's one in development I read that has capability. Once, you know, I mean, I think they use off, but maybe delivering up pounds of thrust. You know, right now the ones that they have is, you know, if you put like a quarter in your hand, you know, that's the thrust you have on these ion vehicles, and a lot of them have 3 engines. And you would think, well, they have 3 engines because now they want the thrust of 3/4. Yeah, they have that capability, but they don't do that. They're actually, you know, they take turns, you know, firing these thrusters. So one will fire, you know, for a year, and then the other one will fire for another year. And, you know, that's what they've been doing with the ion thrust. And, you know, eventually you pick up speed, you know. Pushing, you know, even so, it's a small thrust. You know, eventually, you know, it does work out where it's a lot more efficient than the chemical rockets that we have. But because of the thrust, you know, you can't go to the ground, so you know, they don't fire them up until you're in space. Anyway, getting to Mars, that's going to be. A real challenge. The main goal, of course, right now is to get back to the moon. And of course, they have their hands filled with that with the space launch system. You know, already they tried to fill up the tank over 700,000 gallons of liquid oxygen and liquid helium into that SLS rocket, you know, which was supposed to launch on the 6th of February. And that was delayed and delayed. And, you know, they found leaks. It's always where, you know, where you have the interface between the pipe. Like an eight inch pipe and a 4-inch pipe, and it's connected to this quick disconnect system on the space launch system. And sure enough, that seal is one of the main problems. They also had some other issues in ground support piping. But, you know, it's a tough gas to contain, not the oxygen, but the hydrogen. The hydrogen is so thin that it manages to get past the gaskets. And they're allowed up to, I think they said, 4% leakage rate. And once that gets exceeded, you know, they shut it down, drain the whole system, you know, and start all over again. So I just read where NASA's administrator, Jared Isaacman, is now being confronted with this problem and what to do about it. And, you know, it was a rough read, but I have a feeling they're going to try to re-engineer this whole thing. And if that's true, you know, I don't see this thing being launched anytime soon. It might take months. Any comments?
Yeah, well, certainly take months if NASA does it the traditional way, but, you know, I don't know whether it'd be interesting to see what Isaacman does, since he's a SpaceX person, whether he'll give it to SpaceX and say, here's a pot of money, do it, you know, work 24/7 and do this tomorrow. You know, but, you know, well, that's going to be interesting. Good.
Yeah, I mean, I worry about safety, so, you know, I'm still going to stick with the SLS, you know. You know, it looks like they have two main problems. And once they get past that, I think they'll be okay. One is these constant leaks with the hydrogen. You know, they have the same problem with the space shuttle system. So, hydrogen, you know, it's a tough gas to contain. But the other problem is the heat shield. And I'm going to be concerned about that. We talked about that, I think, last week or the week before. And the first one on Artemis 1 was damaged. And it would have worked. They would have got the crew back safe. But there was a lot more damage than they had anticipated. Evaluated, and they're still not going to change the existing one. It was too hard to remove it. And now on the next Artemis, the one that's going to land on the moon, that is going to have a different process for putting that heat shield together. What they're going to do with this one, they chose to leave it alone, and they're just going to change the way the spaceship enters the atmosphere. They're going to have it skim across the atmosphere, go back into space a little bit, slow it down that way. This way you don't wind up with the 5,000-degree temperatures that you get from coming back from the moon. Orbital velocity, it's slower, 17,500 miles an hour. You wind up with 3,000 degrees temperatures. But Moon and Mars, you come back, you know, they're 25,000 miles an hour, and that's 5,000 degrees. So that's something to be concerned with. And SpaceX is having problems with their heat tiles. They haven't perfected that yet. And to have them all of a sudden take over, and we're going to use this Starship to get to the moon. I mean, they haven't made it to orbit yet. Never mind, you know, putting a crew on board. In fact, they just disconnected the crew arm for Launch Complex 39A, which is the one that they're using two now for crew launches, 40 and 39A. And they disconnected the whole arm. They brought it down on a crane because they're building it out for Starship. And from what I see, they're at least a couple of years away from if things go right, at least a couple of years from now before you could ever even think about putting a person on board the Starship. And at that point, they'll have a different arm, and, you know, for crew access arm, completely different. They won't use the old one. They said the old one they're just going to put into storage in case they need it, whatever that means. So I don't see Elon Musk coming in to save the day on this one. In fact, if anything, I think Jeff Bezos with the lunar land that he's building, which is really coming along. There's two versions of the lander. He calls them Blue Moon, both of them. And then one Blue Moon is a Mark 1. It'll be a cargo vehicle, which they plan on launching very soon. Probably within a couple of months, I'm thinking. And that will be the first one to land on the moon. They have to test, make sure it all works. That engine that they're using, the R7, on that vehicle, they will have three of them instead of one on the cargo vehicle. They'll have three on the crew vehicle, and that's going to be called a Mark 2. That will be one that they will be able to moon. And I, you know, the development of that and the simplicity of that looks a lot better than what SpaceX is planning. So the plan was for Mark 2, for Blue Origin, to eventually bring a crew to the moon. They had contracts with NASA, and they were supposed to be doing Artemis 5 and beyond. Artemis 3 and 4 is supposed to be both Starship. Well, Starship, you know, can't get off the ground. You know, I'm predicting that Blue Origin might be like Mighty Mouse. They're the ones that will be here to save the day. Any comments? WS2N.
Yeah, well, I think as I said, I think it was last week or 2 weeks ago, I find it really interesting that Jared Isaacman, who's a SpaceX person, I'm not sure whether he was technically an employee or a consultant, but anyway, he's flown missions with them, and yet he's apparently convinced the administration to go with the Blue Origin's contract. And yeah, the SpaceX, the Starship lander sounded like a Rube Goldberg, sounds a bit like a Rube Goldberg device, with an elevator to bring the astronauts down from the crew quarters down to the surface and back up again into the lander. It sounds like just too much stuff that has to work in an environment where an elevator has never been tried before. You know, it just sounds like too much untried technology. I wouldn't say it's never going to work, but it's not going to work in any reasonable time frame. And yeah, Blue Origin's kind of been surprising. You know, they monetized their development program by giving tourists brief rides to test out their equipment, and then they made orbit the first try with the New Glenn. And as I understand it, typically no new orbital class rocket makes it the first time, and they did. And I think they did a Mars trajectory the first or second time. So, yeah, that's all surprises on that side. Go ahead.
Yeah, I'm glad they succeeded. And they're going to launch in a couple of... let's see. They're scheduled to launch the end of this month. Again, Blue Origin will be launching New Glenn. And this is the same one the same booster that came back successfully. They're going to relaunch that. They're going to put communication satellite, one of these AST satellites, the one for, you know, supposedly you'll be able to use your cell phone. AST makes something called Bluebird. They're calling this Bluebird 7. Anyway, they're gonna launch the end of the month. And from what I read, it was weird. They said that there's no plan of bringing it back again. I just don't see why they would do that in this case. Unless, the satellite that they're launching is not, you know, it's not going to geosynchronous orbit or anything, and the weight is not tremendous. So there's no reason, I don't think, to use the booster in the expendable mode. Unless they just want to try it, you know, it's to know that how it will work for you know, future launches, like government launches and things where they do that. But anyway, at the end of this month, they're supposed to be launching that thing. The same 7 engines to be 4 engines, liquid gas. They actually use liquid natural gas, LNG. So it's very similar to methane. It's not the same. It's much cheaper to get. It's manufactured around the world. You know, liquid natural gas is shipped all over the place. So it's more of a popular gas, less expensive to use. You know, and they say, well, the methane is slightly cleaner, but there's not much of a difference. I mean, the cost factor for LNG is less. I mean, the 90% of the gas is methane, but, you know, the other 5-10% is ethane and butane, which is no problem. You know, if you look at the booster that came back that landed last time, it's perfect. Looks perfectly clean. Landed on that barge. Compared to the Falcon 9s, it looked like, you know, Falcon 9 looks like it, you know, went through a dirty garage. But when it comes back, they clean it up, and, you know, they relaunched them over and over again 20, 25 different times. But Blue Origin will be able to do that as well. But we'll see. Looking forward to see how that launch goes. Very successful. A couple of the other ones were pretty successful. Relativity, when they went up, they had 85% additive manufacturing, you know, a 3D operation to build that whole, they call it the Terran rock. And, you know, it got off the ground successfully. It was all stainless steel. Well, correction. That might have been aluminum. I think that was aluminum. But anyway, that successfully got off the ground. I think they did have a problem with the second stage. That was pretty successful. We have one that is going to be going up. Firefly has another launch. I believe that's coming up very shortly as well. They've had some problems. Not 100% flights all the time, but this one is supposed to be new and improved. And that's called the what's the name of that one? But Firefly will be going up very shortly as well. I remember what it was. It was the Alpha, rocket. So we'll see how that does. They have a heavy lift vehicle that's being under development with Northrop Grumman. That's called the Eclipse, and that will be launched out of Virginia, Wallops Island, Virginia. Also designed for reusability in the future. So, okay. I just want to mention the rovers on Mars. You know, you have Curiosity and Perseverance still riding around on Mars. I haven't mentioned it before I close. Curiosity has been up there, since 2012? And the other one has been up there since 2021. And they're both nuclear-powered, driving around on Mars. This keeps coming back from these things. Like Curiosity just came up with some other thing that they drilled into, and they analyzed the chemicals, and they analyzed it, and it looks like these chemicals could only be produced by, at one time, you know, life on Mars, you know, maybe millions of years ago. And they say the scientists are having a harder time than ever, because as time goes on, to explain why these life, well, seemingly things that were created by life, they're having a harder time explaining, well, it could have been done naturally, you know, a lightning bolt or a comet hitting the surface, or it created this, created that. And there's so many different things that they keep discovering that they think the first thought is, well, you know, it's an exact duplicate of what we have on Earth that's created by some life form on Earth at one time. So now they're saying, you know, we're running out of, for lack of better words, excuse of what these different things are we keep finding are, how they could possibly exist without some kind of life form. So I wouldn't be surprised if they, in the future, don't know when, probably not too long from now, they're going to have to make a determination, and they're going to have to tell people, this stuff, as far as we're concerned, was created by life. I mean, the signs of water are all over Mars. In fact, there's still water there, up in the poles, they have ice. Yeah, they got frozen carbon dioxide and everything up there, but there's ice that they know that they could eventually get melted down, electrolysis, you have hydrogen, oxygen, the oxygen to breathe, you have the hydrogen mixed with the hydrogen, you can create fuel cells on the planet, you could put it inside of a gigantic rocket and blast off from the planet using hydrogen for the fuel and oxygen as the, I don't know. We'll see. It'd be kind of fun to come back here, 10 years, 20 years from now, and find out, what in the world happened. What's the world going to be like? With that, let me see if there's any last comments before I close. This is WSON. Okay, also, congratulations to the two companies that got their rockets off the ground. Vulcan launched this week, and they first time they went up with four boosters attached. They have the capability of going up to six, but they had four boosters. Last flights had two boosters. Yeah, one of the flights had a problem with one of the boosters. By the way, the boosters are made by Northrop Grumman. One booster on the second flight deteriorated and broke, you know, the nozzle. Sure enough, on this mission, they launched, they had four boosters, and one of them looks like it did the same thing to me. So they're going to have to nail that down for the next launch. Didn't affect the mission. They successfully got the payloads to orbit on both those missions. So, you know, that's not a problem. But they're accepted for government flights now. The other success was European Space Agency launched an Ariane 6 rocket. It's the fourth one that they've done so far. The heavy lift rocket for, it seems like forever, since the late 80s, was the Ariane system. And then last group was Ariane 5, and they had like 85 or 90 flights with the Ariane 5, but then they developed the new Ariane 6, which is supposed to be less expensive to launch, more powerful, and sure enough, they've launched that thing four times so far. It looks like they've been successful on their flights. And this last one that they launched, they put, I think it's 34 satellites into orbit for Blue Origin. Blue Origin has, it's called the LEO satellite now, for low Earth orbit satellites. They changed the name from the Kuiper system to LEO. They're the same thing. But what it is that's their broadband system competing against SpaceX, SpaceX Starlink. So now they have hundreds of satellites, I think probably close to 300 satellites up there now. Actually, have 3,200 satellites up there. Just to give you an idea, that's about one third of the satellites that SpaceX has. For some reason, I guess Blue Origin doesn't need as many. I don't know. We'll see. Any last comments? WS2N for the SpaceNet report.
Nap time complete.
Okay, nothing heard. And I wanted to mention earlier a medical story with the Moderna. I know you put that on your website. And it looks like the government is knocking down their development of the, what is it, the mRNA. You know, that was the system that they used for COVID, which, you know, probably saved millions of people. And I thought that was going to be the cat's meow for future development, but it looks like the government has put a halt on that, which is ridiculous. Anyway, back to you, Roy. AC2GSWS2N for the SpaceNet report for the TechNet. Back to you.
Thank you, Paul. Thank you for the SpaceNet report. Thank you for all that you do on the technical net and all that you do for the club. We all appreciate it. And you could delay innovation, but you can't stop it forever. It'll restart in a couple of years when we wake up from this nightmare. Anyway, thanks to everyone who came by, and especially those who participated. I hope you'll join us next Sunday at 8. When we try and do this all over again. As always, I'd like to leave you with a couple of clever comments, one from our own K2RIW. Dick would often end his technical net with the advice to be kind to each other. That's always good advice. And I always like to bring up good old Epictetus. It's impossible for a man to learn what he thinks he already knows. So keep your mind open to new ideas, but not so wide open that your brain slips out and falls on the ground. You're going to need it one of these days. Anyway, everyone, have a great week. Stay safe, be well, and if you can, possibly join me next Sunday when we try and do this all over again. This is AC2GS formally closing this particular episode of the Limark Technical Net after I say Slava Ukraini.
Thanks, Roy. Thanks, Paul. KC2 message.